This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss local Chicago company Basecamp's new email app, Hey, and the upcoming end of production of Segway. This show was recorded on June 23rd. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
Dateline, a closet in a undisclosed location in south eastern Wisconsin, if I can visualize a compass rose correctly. Well, at least that's where I'm recording from. Graham, where are you?
I am, as I have been most of the times we recorded recently, I am in my childhood bedroom.
Ooh, nice. I know the feeling, man.
God bless COVID. Was my camera not on?
No, your camera's not on. Which I'm sure is it. This is the sort of audio. This is the sort of visual details that is super important to an all audio show. Graham, what does your shirt say? Speaking of visual details, network nerd.
It does in fact say that. I got this shirt from a cybersecurity conference.
Not a sponsor of the show.
Not a sponsor of the show.
All right, man. Well,
hey, Jason, happy birthday.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. I am very recently 30 years old, although as my dear colleague Jed was very quick to point out, turning 30 just means that you are marking the end of your 30th lap around the sun, which technically started when you were born. Not the lap. Yes. The, you know what I mean. Starting the count of the laps. So I turned 30.
Yeah, you're also closer to 40 than 20 now. You're welcome.
You know, Graham, I love talking to you because
all of these kinds of uplifting things.
Well, with absolute surgical precision, you're very good at coming up with something that is funny, true, and is oftentimes just the right amount of deflating.
Nicely backhanded.
Is that your MO?
Maybe.
Maybe. Oh, man. So
I, in just a couple of months here, just a couple short months, I will be closer to 40 than 30. So. Mm-mm.
Dude, hard pass. Yeah. This whole
would not recommend.
No, this whole time is an arrow, all that thing, really, really caught up to me because I'm like, I'm halfway to 60. But this being said, I don't really remember, many details about the first, I don't know. I mean, obviously first few years of my life. And really, I didn't really become like a sentient, fully functional being until I was, when? Like people are 11
last
or 12?
Week?
No. get the hell out of here. No. No. Like, people sort of become conscious of the real world when they're 11 or 12 or 13 or whatever. And so I'm okay, well, I've been a sentient being really in the world for 17 years now. And that really does help because I'm if I barely remember, full details from the first, 10, 12, 13 years, I don't know. I guess everything that I'm experiencing now will just sort of amalgamate into this gray paste that we call time and memory, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I wonder if any of that stuff will be affected by, by COVID.
What? Like the fact that every single day is largely undifferentiated and that there's no way to demarcate one's experience from one day to the next. And it all just, again, flows together in this amalgamated gray paste of time.
But what I specifically meant was if people maturing would be affected in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I think about, you know, younger people who, you know, are now exposed to these really adult topics of like serious disease and things like that, who may not have had that as a, you know, kind of mainstay in their lives, but it's, you know, near inescapable, you know, because of the circumstances.
Yep. What a great way.
By the way,
what a cheerful way to start out the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, a little bit of, you know, pontification's good, right?
Sure. As yes, of course. Graham, unless you had something else to say. Why am I yawning? This is terrible audio. We'll cut all this out.
Well, our show puts ourselves to sleep, so of course it puts our listening audience to sleep.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we could probably find a big audience in like the people who are just about to pass out.
Oh, you know what I could do? I could
read to like a number station.
Oh, Graham, shit dog. You know what? You triggered a memory. Couple of years back, there was a podcast that I found that was called like Number Station, right? And it was this guy reading numbers in a very peculiar voice, and it was all done through some sort of an audio filter, or he had just an awful microphone. But I'm going to assume it was some sort of vocal filter, and it would always start out the same. And I don't know, maybe like 4 or 5 minutes in, then it would start to have this very slight variations, but it was like super duper rhythmic. And so I've mentioned this because somewhere on the very computer that I am recording this this podcast from lies an audio file of me recording myself in GarageBand counting from 1 to 100. With gaps in between. And it was my goal to split up that single track, and then randomly generate sequences of numbers that I can play back to myself as I was going to sleep as a way to relax. And that's probably a deeper peer into my brain than I probably would ever otherwise care to admit in public. But you know, our vast listening audience, I'm sure will find this to be a quirky attribute of my personality, as opposed to a sign that I'm ever so slightly insane.
Okay, well, we'll take the rest of that discussion offline, I think.
Sure, of course. So
we have kind of an interesting show.
But before we got to introduce ourselves.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Fine.
All right. Sure. I'm yelling a lot into this microphone in this very closet, and I'm sure my audio is going to be terrible this episode, but I can start. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. As Graham mentioned, I'm recently 30 years old. That's the least entertaining part about myself. For my day job, I am a researcher at a San Francisco-based startup called Golden, which you can find out more about at golden.com. If you become a Golden client, please tell whoever you end up talking to that Jason sent you, so that I can get a nice pat on the back and nothing more. When I'm not doing that, I do some volunteer work with an open source software foundation, helping place early stage startups at their annual conference, which obviously didn't happen this year because of the pandemic, but we do our best to accommodate and give everybody the best experience possible. And then I also record this little show called Fully Vested with my friend Graham Peck. Speaking of Graham Peck, who are you?
Yeah, I am a venture partner at Midwest-based investing fund Cultivation Capital. We invest in life sciences, ag tech, and then specifically the team that I'm lucky enough to be a member of is our software and IT fund. We invest in seed and series A stage B2B SaaS or otherwise recurrent revenue technology companies when they're in a kind of high growth part of their scaling. In addition to that, I also work with Eastern European software development firm called Brightgrove, helping them to find and manage their North American kind of book of business. We help companies to build and scale their software team with dedicated but remote resources.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. So, Graham, you were saying we have a bunch of stuff that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, so we have two kind of interesting and somewhat random topics. One of these caught my attention in particular because it's right in Jason and my normal backyard, although as we record this, neither one of us is in Chicago. But normally, we are both based in Chicago. And so wanted to talk about Basecamp, a local hometown hero in the tech scene in Chicago. Their recent dispute with Apple over their Hey app and the potential for Apple to try to garner a percentage of the revenue generated through the App Store. And then kind of interestingly, and maybe a little bit off kind of the crosshairs for us, but interestingly enough, I guess we're going to see in just under a month the end of an era when Segway is going to stop, for all intents and purposes, making Segways.
Yeah.
Or what we would think of as Segways, although the company and brand name are not going away.
No. And we will talk, there's a lot of nuance in there. Well, there's a lot of nuance everywhere in the stack. But Graham, let's you want to talk about, I'm trying to think of a clever, witty transition. Hey, Graham.
Hey.
As I shout,
I'm not sure that qualifies, but let's go with that.
Okay. Hey, Graham. What's Hey? What's going on?
So Hey is a really cool app produced by the great folks over at Basecamp, formerly 37 Signals, again Chicago based company, co-founded by Jason Fried and DHH, the one of the originators of the Ruby on Rails programming language. Mm-hmm. Jason, do you have something you want to say there?
No, it's just his full name is David Hanemeyer Hansen.
Continue. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Goes typically by DHH. In any case, Chicago-based company, and they recently produced what they think is a superior way to read email. And without getting on like a whole tangent about that, because I think everyone's got their own stack and kind of flow for how that works. And mine for the moment is not working great because I have a couple of technical snafus and quite simply just too many email boxes to read and actively stay on top of. So I've thought about switching to something like this or also maybe trying out Superhuman. We talked in a prior episode about the way that Superhuman uses tracking pixels, which is specifically one of the things that Hey blocks. In any case, part of the reason we're recording this so late is I was actually watching the full 37-minute product demo video about Hey just out of curiosity. And that's Jason Fried, one of the founders and CEO of Basecamp, walking you through it in great detail. I think there's a huge kind of place in the world for these apps that improve workflow, in particular in email, since so many people spend so much time in their email boxes day in and day out. All of that being said, specifically the topic here is that Apple approved the Hey app for sale or for download
distribution,
via the App Store. And when the developers discovered some sort of bug, they wanted to push a bug update. And when they submitted that bug fix version of the app, Apple said, no, unless you allow us to collect our typical 15 to 30% fee on any revenue generated through the App Store. And this has really become a pretty substantial battle. And then some of the articles that we'll reference in the show notes, even talk about, another Chicago company, Cameo, which allows purchase only through their website, not the App Store. Mm-hmm. And so they've been kind of battling this similarly.
And other companies too, you know, Netflix.
Those are just two of the most recent examples.
Sure. But, you know, like similarly, you don't have to give Apple, 30% of the MSRP for buying a Tesla and being able to use the Tesla app on your iPhone, all this other stuff. Graham, what's your take on this situation? I'm sure you have an opinion. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I definitely have an opinion. But I kind of see both sides of it, right? The Hey app would certainly not be as valuable potentially to its users or its developers if there weren't mass distribution, media like mm-hmm. iPhones, Android, computers. And they obviously don't make any of those. They just make software that runs on them. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. So it kind of makes sense from that side that there'd be some interplay, of the financial arrangement. But at the same time, if you are simply a software developer and you just want other people to use your software, but you are platform agnostic, then I totally get why you would say, hey, wait a minute. Again, as you point out, if somebody's buying a Tesla and going to use the app to unlock their car, just for that, not exactly, but relatively simple functionality, you don't deserve to take some huge rake over this, this product of mine that simply relies on your screen to gain full functionality. So I kind of see both sides of it. I would say in general, I probably fall down much more on Basecamp's side of things.
Okay.
Of, hey, wait a minute, you guys are just a platform that enables this and my technology runs through it. If I'm not directly charging for something that is sold in the App Store exclusively, but instead I'm allowing a download of software that's connected to another subscription I've got, then hands off my wallet, Apple. Sure. But
don't try it on my app.
But I would also say that, like, I am trying to acknowledge my own like self bias that Apple is just a wealthy big company and so they kind of don't deserve it. But that's not generally the way that I think. But I mean, obviously, a company that's sitting on whatever, $250-300 billion of cash in the bank,
they're like, doing okay.
Right, right. And, and they had, what did the report say, over $500 billion, I think, of total turnover. Was that the number? $519 billion
something dollars like
in total, I think.
It's nuts.
Of total transactions were transacted through the App Store.
Yeah.
It's interesting because this kind of feud became so public at the same time as a European group began or it was formally announced that the European some sort of regulatory body started exploring the potential of antitrust against Apple for things for business practices very similar to this.
Yeah.
So where do you fall down or what's your opinion or
sure. So
how do you look at maybe both sides of this?
Yeah. Okay. So I forget where I heard this. It may have been on one of my favorite podcasts. I want to say it was on the Accidental Pod. Sorry. Words are hard, Graham. I want to say it was on the Accidental Tech Podcast. And I forget who brought this up. And it may not have been on that podcast. Anyways, it's the idea that like when Apple first announced the App Store, and they said, we are going to be taking a 30% cut of proceeds from sales on this, on this platform. If you go back and listen to the, keynote where they announced this, developers were just freaking out excited. And the reason why is because, prior to the App Store, if you wanted your sort of like individual proprietary software, loaded onto a mobile device, it would be put into the hands of, tens or hundreds of thousands or even millions of users, there would be a great deal of negotiation with, like, you know, the original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, and then also carriers. And, like, carriers put just, like, massive amounts of, like, you know, shovelware and just crappy apps on people's cell phones. And moreover, you know, between carriers and OEMs taking their cuts, you know, like, we're talking about, like, a 70% take rate going to the carriers and the OEMs. So, you know, I understand that, you know, we're close to, you know, a decade since the, you know, around a decade since the launch of the App Store. But, like, at least at the time, you know, it was a very compelling deal, a compelling bargain to developers. You know, grant us the right to have a walled garden around our hardware and OS platform. And in exchange, we, quote unquote, only take 30%, assuming, of course, that your app meets a number of other, you know, guidelines around quality and general, like, you know, non-scumminess and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that in general, like, the App Store has been obviously great for Apple financially, but it's also, I think, been pretty good for developers in general, at least relative to what the status quo was in the past. Now, obviously, things have changed pretty radically over the past decade or so because, you know, with the emergence of alternate platforms such as Android, which do have, you know, ways of, you know, loading apps, downloading apps, sideloading apps that do not necessarily get routed directly through the Google Play Store, ergo not giving Google its own little, you know, commensurate cut of revenue. You know, I can see why people and regulators included also view the App Store as the sort of, like, monopoly provider of third-party software to iOS as being somewhat problematic from a market structure standpoint, right? And that there might be some legitimate reason to raise some flags around around possible antitrust stuff.
We could try to put an app in the App Store that is an App Store.
Well, you can't do that. Fun fact.
Oh, that's right.
Right. See, because, like, this is just a thing that just happened with Facebook, right? I don't know if you followed the. Did you see the thing about Facebook Gaming? Okay, so
no.
So Facebook, this has been another, like, little side channel narrative that's been happening. Side channel, I didn't use correctly, but whatever. This is another, like, little side narrative, little storyline that's been going alongside the Hay stuff, which is at Facebook, you know, large company based in, I think they're still in Menlo Park, wherever, you know, whatever it is, Silicon Valley, big company, you know, releases they wanted to build, like, a little gaming platform, which would have had some flavor of subscription, component to it. And Apple basically made them iterate away all of the things that made the game subscription service that Facebook wanted to publish feel like an app store. So you weren't able to. So, for example, I have not seen, like, the very first original, like, screenshots of, like, what they'd wanted to publish on the App Store. But, you know, like, you would have, I don't know, it'd be like a directory of games that you'd be able to sort and, you know, view by category and say, like, you know, oh, I want to download a racing game, or I want to play a fantasy role-playing game, or whatever other types of genres of games, right? No, that seems too
Jason, I've got a really important question for you.
Sure.
While I'm away for the next few days, can you tend to my crops for me?
In which game?
Oh, in Farmville. Right. Do Farmville references not work anymore?
I don't think they do.
Oh, okay.
I mean, dude, if you wanted to be all hip, you'd say, you know, you'd be like, dude, can you come water my flowers in Animal Crossing? I'll give you my my best friend code on Switch. You know, yada yada. But anyways. Where was I? Facebook. You know, Apple had made Facebook remove all of the features that made their game subscription service feel like a app store or a directory of apps or a directory of whatever. So removing the categories, removing the ability to sort, right? You know, and it's not just like, oh, cool. Like now I can just go click on this, what's effectively just like an HTML list that's like styled in like Facebook's colors and fonts of some like random jumble of games. And I guess I can tap on something and have it download to my device and let me play it, you know, for a monthly subscription fee or whatever, whatever exactly the business model was. Is that an example of Apple using its, you know, market power to say to Facebook, another extremely large, powerful technology company, like, hey, sorry, you can't have your service on our platform, parentheses, because it also competes with our own subscription game offering. I think it's called Apple Arcade. Yes, that's exactly what's happening. What is my feelings on this? It's like, not to like both sides of this, but I do see a point on both sides. Like Apple has an incentive to limit distribution of applications which subvert their own, you know, revenue take from the App Store, right?
Sure.
Of course.
And probably reasonably so, because, you know, to make the $500 billion of total, you sure. know, business be facilitated, you know, they do spend a lot of money, you know, yeah. to make that possible.
Yeah. I mean, you have app reviews, you have, you know, all this. Anyways. So you know, there's that. Does Apple furthermore have an incentive? And again, we're not talking about hey here. We're talking about, you know, sort of now this Facebook thing, but we'll get back to hey. Does Apple furthermore have an incentive to limit the distribution of, you know, be able to, perhaps better phrasing would be like to exert editorial control and say like, hey, we don't want apps on our app store that feel like app stores, because that could lead to confusion between, you know, on the user side, between like, well, what's the official Apple store app store or what's the official app Apple app store versus like an app store that's run by a third party. Like, I totally see that too.
Sure.
But, you know, you still get back to this, like, you know, potential antitrust stuff of like Apple has this walled garden around its, you know, for selling apps. It also has a walled garden around its operating system, right? It has a I've not yet seen a way to like jailbreak like a Google Pixel into running iOS. I'm sure somebody's figured it out. But like Apple has a monopoly on the ability to have a device that runs iOS, and Apple also has a monopoly on Apple is the only company that makes iPhones, somewhat obviously, to add just another level of, you know, proprietariness to Apple, like now announced officially at WWDC this week yesterday as we record. You know, they made official rumor. They've officially confirmed what has been rumored for years, which is that Apple is going to be moving, at least on its Mac line, gradually away from Intel processors and toward ARM processors that Apple designs and fabs itself. So, I kind of understand and am somewhat sympathetic to the idea that, like, Apple is flexing its market power in ways that that do benefit Apple. But I'll just say full disclosure, as like a lifelong Apple user, you know, my first computing experience was on an Apple computer. all of my computers except for like a little stupid gaming PC, you know, my dad got us when we were kids, have been Apples in some way or another. I've been an iOS user since 3 weeks after the first iPhone launched, which I did spend full ticket price for, and then took my $100, App Store gift card or iTunes gift card, whatever it was at the time. So like, I'm biased myself. I'm as big an Apple fanboy as most, but at the same time, like, I think that Apple's control over all this stuff has ultimately led to a better user experience from the software, like from the OS and hardware perspective, and then also probably a better user experience from the third-party software perspective, because Apple is able to exert some level of editorial say over what gets published in the App Store for distribution to users, such that, you know, I've yet to run into unwanted pornography in a app that I've downloaded from the App Store. I do not feel at risk of having my, you know, identity stolen in a formal sense, in a way that's worse than whatever. If obviously, like, Facebook is not stealing your identity, but it does track you and stuff. Like I'm less concerned about the security implications of apps that I've downloaded from the Apple App Store than I would be, say, sideloading apps via jailbreaking my iPhone or being an Android user and being able to download and use apps from things that are not the official sanctioned Google Play Store. But that might just be me. That might just be me being a bit of a wimp and a little cowardly on certain things too. So I'm sympathetic to. I'm very sympathetic to Apple, and I'm also very sympathetic to Facebook. But let's bring it back to, hey, like, Apple's a giant company. It has massive revenues, as we previously discussed. Facebook, obviously, similarly, I mean, not as big, but big. Smaller publishers, this is where things get to be a little bit more of a sticky wicket. Because, like, I mean, 37 Signals, I have no understanding of what their revenues are, like, as a company. They're privately held. But, you know, my wager would be that a 30% haircut off of, you know, revenues from the Apple App Store would hit, you know, Basecamp harder than, say, a 30% skim followed by a 15% skim, you know, for every year after the first, would affect an organization, you know, like Facebook, which does have a much more diversified set of revenue streams than Basecamp or the little team over at Hey. So that was a very long, rambling monologue there, but yeah, that's sort of initially my thoughts in a little bit of a nutshell. Last thing I'll just say, like, I do think that there's room to, like, liberalize, and I'm talking about liberalize in, like, the old school sense of liberalize, not like, it's not like politically left or whatever, just like freeing up bits and pieces of the App Store to allow for, certain types of, like, you know, sideloading of content or apps or figuring out more amicable ways to split revenue with companies that want to have their apps published. You know, maybe whether it's through a large, like, a lump sum up front or whatever. I don't know. You know, there's lots of different ways to shake that tree out, you know?
Yeah, you know, it is interesting to think about. A lot of things I think become really obvious once you've either said them, read them, heard them, you know, whatever you know, kind of your first experiences with something. And I'm kind of thinking back on some of my own comments from a couple minutes ago. And I haven't spent as much time as I probably should have thinking about the interplay or what I said a few minutes ago of symbiosis of hardware and software. And so if you're a software developer, and I'm not, but I work closely with a lot of them on both kind of the funding and also actually like team formation sides of things.
Sure.
In different projects that I work on, you're really dependent upon these modern hardware and or platform providers to do a combination of host, but also just literally host the user experience on these very devices. And you couldn't be a very effective software developer, without that. And those hardware devices all benefit from, and probably their literal stats of what they're physically and software-wise capable of are pushed by the needs of those software developers. So I think it's a very symbiotic relationship, and it's mutually beneficial in some ways and mutually detrimental in others, right?
Yeah, totally.
In the services world, like taking this to more akin to kind of the services side of things, of software development or probably a lot of other industries, I can think of kind of the suggestion you ended on. You know, a lot of times somebody will say, hey, you know, either bring me a lead and I'll pay you a little bit, whether it pans out or not, or bring me a lead, help me close a deal, and I'll pay you some percentage, maybe in perpetuity, but often as a one-time fee.
Sure.
It's either a percentage of that deal or a flat fee as long as the contract meets certain criteria. I certainly could get a model where Hayes said to Apple, or Google Play for that matter, hey, if you bring us a new customer, we will gladly pay you $30 once. Or whatever.
And then $15 the next year.
Very possibly, because that's probably valuable for them, but they also probably need to know upfront and have that baked into their economics. And so with trying to come out of the gate with assuming you don't want a two or three letter email address at hey.com, a $99 per year price point, and then finding out that you're going to have a 15 to 30% VIG in there that you didn't plan for, I certainly get why that could be problematic, depending on their business model, depending on their team and expectations for size and scale. And it's probably, unfortunately, even more harmful the smaller they are.
Totally. I mean, so like bringing it down to a, to like a more to like kind of like the nuts and bolts, the brass tacks of, what this show, Fully Vested is about, which is sort of the world of startups and venture and stuff. I haven't really seen a lot of very big rounds for companies that only distribute a paid app, on the App Store, like where you pay once. I mean, you've seen in-app purchases. You have now Apple recently, only in the past, few years has allowed for the ability to buy a subscription through the App Store. And I understand what they're doing. They want it, it's advantageous for them to have an ever more closed garden or ever more walled garden. But at the same time, it's delivering, at least in theory, a better, safer user experience to people who may not be as digitally savvy as, say, some of the folks that listen to our show. I would personally feel much safer giving, an older relative an iPhone and saying, hey, you can sign up, give them your credit card once and create a username and password that'll let you buy apps using your credit card, than saying, oh, hey, here's this janky device. Here's all this weird software that looks kind of janky and like may or may not brick your phone, but you can download and install any app that you want. Like, I know why Apple's doing this. It also just works out that it makes fantastic strategic and economic sense for them too. But
oh yeah, of course.
But like, there's definitely an opportunity for that to loosen a bit. And back to the world of startups and stuff. Like, you know, I don't know if I would advise a company that wanted to make money from a mobile app to, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd just say like, deal with it a little, like it's the cost of doing business.
And that's what I keep thinking of, is there are also a lot of companies that rely on that as their source of lead flow, and they do almost, if not all, of their marketing inside those types of app-based platforms, and they're thrilled every time they give Apple 15 or 30%, because for them, again, assuming their economics work out, it means they've got a new customer and probably a recurrent revenue stream for months or years, depending on their churn and what their business is. And so there are a lot of businesses that are completely dependent on, maybe exclusively in many cases, dependent upon only the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store as their sole sources of new customers, and very likely the only two places that they do anything that consists of advertising or marketing.
Right.
Now, they may have some content, they may run a Facebook or Google ad, but in general, I think there are a lot of businesses that bring in 100% of their customers through probably just one of those two platforms.
Or like the ads that they do on Facebook, or, I mean, Facebook ads in particular are, I mean, at least they used to be. I haven't seen the statistics recently, but and by recently, I mean, like, I haven't looked at this in the last, like, I don't know, 9 months. But at least as I recall, you know, Facebook ads are incredibly effective at driving downloads of apps, you know, and so like that's a cost of user acquisition. You know, the take rate from a marketplace is a cost of, you know, it's a cost of user acquisition. It's ultimately a cost of revenue, you know, that you have to, that people have to pay. Because, like, I don't know. I mean, like, I don't want to be like an Apple apologist here, but like, if it wasn't for a platform that is used by predominantly, you know, more affluent people, folks that can afford to spend many hundreds of dollars, you know, on a cell phone, you know, who probably have disposable income, like, seems like a pretty appealing demographic that you want to sell to. And, you know, by offering an app on the Apple App Store, at least as it stands today, you have a opportunity to keep 70% of what would it for the first year, 70%, and then, you know, 85% thereafter of what would have otherwise been $0 if you didn't have access to such a affluent and, you know, technically curious user base. I don't know. Maybe everybody's going to say, "Oh, Jason's the Apple shill," you know, here on the show. And for the record, I do own less than a dozen shares of Apple, which I've made as my very first trade as a legal adult when I was 18, which was a very good bet.
So a lot of people go out and buy cigarettes and lottery a porn tickets. Magazine on their 18th birthday, and lottery
Apple,
tickets,
I,
and
I,
you,
I bought
you bought Apple shares.
Dude, 2008 was a great time.
I was going to say, it's probably made a hell of a lot of money for you. If you bought a dozen shares then you've got a lot more than a dozen shares now.
I've benefited from Apple's economics. So full disclosure on that. I've liquidated, you know, most of it over time, but you know, fine. I'm biased. I'm in the bin for Apple, I guess. But like,
I mean, you know, while my primary phone is a Google Pixel today, I have all Apple products other than that. The computer on which we're speaking is Apple. I have both a large and a small iPad.
Ooh, you got the multi-path lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one other interesting thing, I was just pulling this up. After seeing the report that there was about $519 billion of commerce through the App Store, that is nearly, like, just a skosh under 0.6% of the estimated 2019 worldwide GDP.
I can believe it.
It's through the Apple App Store.
I can believe it.
So said another way, and all of these numbers, of course, are probably using estimates and just best of what's publicly available, although sure, we can link to these sources that I'm getting these numbers from in the show notes if anybody wants to dispute me. You know, so the worldwide economy was just over 87, like just over 87 and a quarter trillion dollars in 2019. That is still an estimate as we record this in nearly the middle of 2020. And per Apple's own press release that came out right around the same time as this investigation that we've mentioned was launched, you know, their 2019 top line revenue was $519 billion. So by just putting those two numbers together, you get that 60 cents out of every $100 or just over 59 cents out of every $100 spent worldwide year long was spent on the Apple App Store, which is truly incredible.
Bananas. Anyway. I mean, it speaks to the scale of the company, right? Like it is, it's not worth like $1.5 trillion or whatever it is for nothing. I get it. Apple's a big company. It flexes its muscles. I do think that there's opportunity for evolution in its own policies and perhaps surface area for regulators to step in if it can be proven that Apple has been anti-competitive in its policies and practices to the detriment of consumers. Personally, it's that detriment to consumers part that I think is going to be hardest to prove. But again, I'm not a lawyer. Precisely because somebody can just come back and say, I'm not a developer, but like, if you're a developer, you only, you know, and you're designing for iOS, like apart from having to take into account a couple of different screen sizes, and like certain just hardware capabilities, like you don't really have to be mindful of like a whole lot of like many different variables. Like, whereas if you're designing for Android, like who knows what the hell kind of device your app's going to run on. And accordingly, like you have to design an app that is good enough to operate on many different types of devices, which means that it is not going to be great on many types of devices. So, you know, fine. Did people in the App Store end up paying perhaps maybe a little bit more? Maybe. Does that constitute consumer harm? Yeah, by the current, you know, rules and regulations. Are there sort of like non-monetary factors that that could redound to Apple's favor, at least from an argumentative perspective, you know, countering one of these cases? Yeah, almost certainly. So I don't know. This is going to be, this to me feels like one of those things that like, you know, oh, time will tell. Like this is going to be really fascinating to watch over time. How this plays out both with Hay and more generally, you know, Apple's relationship with federal regulators, at least in the United States and the EU and other major markets where they're subject to regulation, which is basically everywhere because they're a global company. And then,
but also with small tech companies.
Yes, and then that rely on
Apple to help get their products in the hands of their users.
Right, like you know, Apple worked out. See, here's the thing: like Apple worked out some sort of a deal with Amazon. You know, around selling. I don't know. It was like, oh, you can't include links in your apps unless it's like the Amazon app or whatever. It was like you can't link to something outside of the Apple App Store unless it was you know, like you just couldn't do it because it would have, you know, sidestepped, you know, Apple's little cut that they take of everything that goes through like in-app purchases or whatever, whatever. But like, no, at the end of the day, like the Amazon app on my iPad or my iPhone is basically just a web view for the Amazon.com site, right?
Similarly,
similar deal with Netflix, right? Apple had to remove the ability for people to subscribe to Netflix in the Netflix app. You have, if you download the Netflix app and you don't have an account and you go to it on your iPad or your iPhone or whatever, like, there's no clear indication of like, oh, you know, hello user, in order to use this service, you must go to Netflix.com and enter your credit card info and then use your email address and password to log into this service to access your subscription content. There is no indication that says that because in order to comply with App Store rules and regulations, Netflix had to remove it. Is that bad for users? Maybe, probably, really inconvenient at the least. Is it bad for Netflix? Of course it is, because it means that it's an extra level of sign-up friction for the precisely 12 people on the planet that have never used Netflix before, you know, to go and subscribe. So, yeah, I see both sides. Both sides has turned into like a political little cudgel these days, and I don't want to be accused of it. If anything, I'm in the tank for Apple, but yeah, it's one of these things that'll just have to evolve over time, and God knows there's going to be plenty of opportunity for us to follow up and continue discussing it.
Yep. As we record this episode, Apple's market cap is just below $1.6 trillion, and I believe they are still sitting atop the list of companies as ranked by market cap. And obviously, that's in the middle of some impact from a global pandemic on worldwide markets still.
Sure.
So
good for them. I mean, good for them. Congratulations, you made you're a multi-trillion-dollar company. That's a lot of, that's $1,000 billion.
Well, almost 1,600.
$1,600 billion. $1,600 that's right. Billion dollars.
Billion dollars.
It's a lot
that's
of billions.
Right. Yes, it's a lot.
Oh my God.
Now, to be clear, that's just market cap, which is only one measure of how big a company is. But
sure, yes.
Many people would argue that it's probably the most valuable way to measure big publicly traded companies against one another.
Graham, they liquidate all that. They can fund 16 SoftBank Vision funds.
Ah, and that's exactly what I'd recommend they do with that. Only 14 and a half or 15 if they went for SoftBank Vision Fund 2.
All right, Graham. Enough of hey. We'll see how this all shakes out.
One last comment is that Hey has actually put a portal on their website where they're just aggregating all of the kind of negative information and everyone's press releases and news articles about this. We'll link to that in our show notes. But the team over at Hey has recognized that this is such substantial a problem, and they're trying to garner support from their current and potential customers so much that if you go to hey.com/Apple, you can in fact find links to all of this and like their views on this and everything. The page is literally titled Apple versus Hey, Antitrust and Monopoly. So
we know where Hey stands on this.
in case it wasn't clear before.
It's gonna be fun. Less fun. Well, maybe more fun. Fun to be had. Graham, real quick, just to wind down the show. You and I, we're during normal non-pandemic times, mostly residents of the great city of Chicago, Illinois, in these fine fair states of the United States of America. I've really butchered that phrasing.
A little bit.
And, we've seen folks riding Segways, doing Segway tours along Lakeshore Drive, not on the drive itself, but you know what I mean, on the sidewalks, like, you know, they're popular things with tourists, with mall cops, with lots of other folks. And I don't know if you remember when the original Segway launched. It was like, do you remember that?
I do vaguely. I've ridden one once, and that's probably my most memorable kind of Segway thing. We were at a large air show type of event with, mm-hmm. you know, thousands or probably tens of thousands of people. It was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and I think for that
oh my gosh.
Week, most years, that is the busiest airport in the world by takeoffs and landing count, certainly not by passenger count. The United States Navy, I believe, usually brings an aircraft carrier into the Great Lakes just so they can fly all of the military demos off of that, as well as other, you know, bases around the country. Anyway, long story short, was at this really cool air show, and there was the option for a pretty small amount of dollars to ride a Segway for, you know, 15 minutes or something with a trainer who helped you learn the balance and coordination yeah. and steering mechanics. And it was really a fun experience. And that's probably the closest I've been to a Segway. And I don't know when that was, but I think I was in high school. So that would have been like within a couple years of them coming out.
Sure. I actually have a fun Segway story. So Graham, you know this, listeners may not. Summer 2015, I had a very interesting internship in Silicon Valley. I was working with a venture firm helping build a deal flow pipeline for them. And for folks here who do not work in venture, a lot of that means like taking meetings with other venture investor type folks, taking lots and lots of meetings with startups. And anyways, I was visiting my friends. I'm trying to figure out how much I can say here. I was visiting my friends over at the Soma offices of Crunch Fund, which now goes by a different name. Not because I visited the office, because of other things. And in the office of Crunch Fund was one of the early Segway. It was either like one of the first ones from like the first production run, or it was like a very late prototype before it went into mass production, and it still worked. And I got to ride a Segway, much to the chagrin of whoever probably found the Segway not where they left it when after I rode it, around the downstairs of the Crunch Fund office in Soma. And the office had a fantastic wrought iron staircase. It was a spiral staircase, and I pretty severely hit the back of my head as I was rolling in reverse, and then I hit my head on the stupid stairwell. That's my Segway story.
Nice.
It was great.
Nice.
It was great.
The ending of mine is that my mom, who would love me telling this story in this forum,
sure.
My mom went off of the course where these little Segway demo region was at the Oshkosh Air Show. Yeah, and it was only segregated by cones, so there was no physical barrier. So she went off of the course, and by the time her trainer was running after her at full speed and caught up to her, she was bearing down on a small child in a stroller.
She did not
hit the child in the stroller, but it was a close call, to say the least. And my I haven't been on a Segway either, but needless to say, my mother has not been on a Segway since.
Well, Graham, this is a fantastic segue to say that these experiences that we've just relayed to our long suffering listeners, who at this point have been listening to us for approximately an hour. We may not have an opportunity to ride those two-wheeled self-balancing little people transporter devices with the little stock and the handlebars and the whatever, because Segway, the company, is ceasing production of the Segway people transporter or whatever they call it. It'll be done at the end of the month.
July 15th.
Forgive me.
Not that it matters.
Well, it's about a month from now. It's a little less than a month from now. 3 weeks from now, as we record today, plus or minus. many of the folks in, you know, who'd worked on that project or and in the manufacture of it are going to be laid off. So obviously, unfortunate story there. But it really speaks, at least in my opinion, and we'll try to make this very quick because otherwise we're going to turn this into an hour and a half show, which is not the goal. To me, it just really speaks to the transition that, or maybe to the fact that the Segway never really did properly find like product market fit, apart from mall cops and tourists.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think was interesting is in the article, at least that I read, and I think the article that you read as well, the original estimate was that they would sell up to 100,000 Segways within the first 13 months post-launch. I don't know why you would choose 13 months, but okay. So their estimate was that they would sell up to 100,000 Segways in the first 13 months after launch. And I believe, including the last handful that will be produced over these next 3 weeks, in nearly 20 years, they've only sold 140,000 in total. So in nearly two decades of production, stopped in a couple of weeks now, they have only sold 40% more than their original, essentially, first-year launch plan.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, there was all this talk about how the Segway is going to, like, revolutionize the urban transportation environment, and it's going to allow a new type of pedestrian, you know, traffic, and yada, yada. And like, don't get me wrong. Like, I thought that those sort of, like, visions of the future were kind of great. And, like, you know, apart from the fact that, like, people kind of ended up looking a little bit dorky on them. No offense to people who love their Segways at all. You know, like they, the Segway itself may not have really achieved that vision. However, Segway as a company, which is now like Segway Ninebot as a company, has helped to, through its other line of personal transport devices and electric scooters, has really actually made a dent in the way that people get around cities. You know, Segway Ninebot being the principal manufacturer, at least for a while, of the scooters used by services like Lime and Bird and stuff like that, which is a whole other can of wax, ball of worms, whatever, for a different show. But even though the actual like original Segway, you know, will come to a quiet and perhaps, you know, ignominious end in a few weeks, the company itself sort of does live on in a way, and the sort of original vision of the Segway, you know, device has in a way come to pass. It just was not that actual device.
Yeah, you know, so I think maybe the bigger point that you either just made or came really close to making is, you know, that vision of the future that Segway, you know, really, I don't know, proposed, I think in a lot of ways, especially, you know, the great scooter wars of a couple years ago, which I think we've talked about on this show before.
A little bit.
Whether those episodes aired or not. But yeah, I mean, so I think that vision that Segway originally had in some way, shape, or form has become true. And they were actually one of their sister company or whatever ended up being some of the biggest participants in that vision. It just wasn't on the actual namesake product of the company.
Yeah. What's the book? Okay, anybody who is interested in, I want to just quickly Google this and then we can end our show. I want to say, what was it called? Perhaps one of the most wild and interesting books that I've read is a book about the Segway device. And I want to say that the book was called like, I'll put it in show notes, but everybody should read it. I think the thing was called like Project Ginger or something like that, like, you know, way back in the day. Hang on one sec. Real-time Googling ensues. We can cut all this out. But
It's interesting that even Steve Jobs, you know, said that this is like going to be one of the biggest products, yes, you know, ever.
I was right.
And, you know, he said that, you know, it was like a bigger product launch than anything ever, you know, including the Macintosh. And, you know, of course, his famous quote of like a bicycle for the mind. I mean, not that this is in the same category as bicycle, but just really interesting.
It's tangential bicycle.
Well, yeah, personal transportation vehicle, certainly. But in any case, it's just interesting that even Steve Jobs, tying this both back to the last story and to Apple, you know, said that this was something he thought would be bigger even than the Macintosh.
Totally. I was correct. The book is titled Codename Ginger, The Story Behind Segway and Dean Kamen's Quest to Invent a New World by Steve Kemper. Published by Harvard Business School Press in the year, don't have the date. Anyways, really good read. And then I also just found the article from The Guardian announcing the launch of the Segway, or the unveiling of the Segway. That article published December 3rd, 2001. We'll put a bunch of stuff in. We'll put a bunch of stuff in show notes just so anybody who wants to go take a march down memory lane or a roll down memory lane on a Segway can. Want to wrap it up, Graham?
Yeah, well, RIP to Segway, and good luck to our Chicago folks over at Hay and, you know, fighting the tech giant Apple.
Segway is dead. Long live the Segway. Mm-hmm.